This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Hello, my name is Lila Roop. I'm a faculty member in Women's Studies here at UC Santa Barbara, and I'm also the other associate dean of the Division of Social Sciences, and I need to introduce Phoebe. I bring my care work with me. I've been involved in intimate labor all morning. After that really stimulating keynote address, I'm happy to welcome you to this panel on the political economy of intimate labor, states, markets, and families, where I think we'll take up a lot of the issues that have been raised already. Our first speaker really needs no introduction. Eileen Boris, as you've already heard, the Hull Professor and the Chair of the Women's Studies Program. I call her the Chair, or maybe that's the love seat. She's affiliated with history, black studies, and law and society here at UC Santa Barbara. She's the author, among other works, of Home to Work, Motherhood, and the Politics of Industrial Homework in the United States, and with Jennifer Klein, Associate Professor of History at Yale University. She's finishing Caring for America, How Home Care Workers Became the New Face of Labor. Professor Klein, who could not be with us today, is the author of For All These Rights, Business, Labor, and the Shaping of America's Public-Private Welfare State. And Eileen's and Jennifer's paper is The Bonds of Home, Reproducing Race and Gender in the U.S. Welfare State.
Of course, I had expected Jennifer to give the paper, but she inconveniently had premature twins this summer. So she's involved in her own caring labors. So without much ado. The paper that I've written that some of you have had an opportunity to read is part of a larger project that has two main goals. First, we're trying to give a history to the amazing organizing victories in the late 1990s of home health care workers, particularly in California. I was very excited about, here was a group of low-paid, immigrant, women of color predominantly, dispersed in homes, and how could such a group come together and really have the first major labor victory since the sit-down strikes of the 1930s. So I wanted to give a history to that. But in trying to give that history, we discovered we had a story about the welfare state. And we had a story about the post-war welfare state that was one, usually the story is, we have the New Deal, and it's for security, and we have this divided welfare state between provision in the public sphere and the private sphere, and that there are divisions between the deserving poor and the undeserving recipients of public monies. And we have discovered through looking at home care, a undivided welfare state in which two breaking downs of separate spheres occurs. The first is that rather than having the public here and the private here, that we can see the history of the modern state in the United States, and in fact our colleague Gary Gostel is going back even to the early republic, that we see not this division between public and private, but in fact they depend and feed off of each other, and that the private does some of the work for the public, and that the public uses the private, and the private depends on the public, and we can't say there's a separate sphere. And this becomes particularly important in something like home care, which, as we heard, we have this ideological notion of separate spheres, that somehow the realm of care in the home cannot be one of paid labor or should not be. And secondly, that this undeserving group of people, that is, in the U.S. context, poor single mothers on what's called welfare, stand apart from the good recipients. Even Ronald Reagan, when he was the governor of California, talked about the deserving poor through no fault of their own, that is the frail elderly and many of the disabled people. In that sense, George W. Bush is to the right of Ronald Reagan. Well, somehow that we have this division between the deserving and the undeserving. And what home care shows us that, in fact, they too are interconnected. That the goal of the post-war welfare state in the United States was not security, the New Deal measure, but the ending of dependency, going back to an early pre-New Deal goal of charity in the private sphere. You're going to end dependency. But even the New Deal itself, Roosevelt wanted to end dependency and using public monies for it. So we show that the way the state organizes home care, and it does not get organized without struggle among many different kinds of actors, including different professionalizing groups, social welfare, medical workers, nurses, reformers of all stripes, and social movements, not only workers, but the independent living movement and seniors. In the process of this occupation coming into being as its own occupation, what was considered private, that is in the home and in the voluntary sector of the economy, in private, philanthropic, nonprofits, social settlement houses, social welfare, family welfare organizations, becomes public through state funding, even if the actual provision of services may be through a family agency or a visiting nurse association or even a private as opposed to a publicly owned hospital. And in the process opens up the possibility for political struggle. It becomes then a political project. And elsewhere we've talked about what this has meant for organizing. But today I want to talk about the home and the bonds of home and what I mean about that. There's no place like home. Home, sweet home. You know, you all have your favorite phrases like that. Home ties, going home, home place. These phrases, of course, evoke comfort and safety, repose, and intimacy. A man's home is his castle. Of course, that suggests not only the power behind doors, gesturing towards female dependency and male dominance, but when recalled by jurists, has served to affirm protection from state entrance into the domestic sphere, and has also been used to say anti-regulation in the labor contract as well as the marriage contract. Wage labor was both out of place at home, but so was state regulation. At stake was freedom of contract and the sanctity of private property used as a green light for low wages, long hours, and exploitative working conditions. But of course, all of this has a history. And what I'm going to focus on mostly in my time is what happens under neoliberalism. Hopefully I'll get to that anyway. So the question is, how can cash enter the realm of affection? And we hear this asked, where love rather than money is to rule. How can home care then be regulated by the state? And these questions pervade public discussion today as much as they did 50 years ago. So when mothers and wives soothe the distressed, tend the ill, or clean the incapacitated, we name their actions love, devotion, duty. But when strangers do it for pay, well, that's just unskilled work that anyone can do. So the question becomes, how did the United States come to the point where labor necessary to maintain living became invisible, undercompensated, and defined as not real work? And we could go through many possible explanations, but I'm a historian, basically, even though I'm in a women's studies program, and even though somewhat interdisciplinary. And so I go to the historical record, and I go through some other discussions in the paper, but you can read the paper. So to see the home as a workplace for paid as well as unpaid family labor, we turn to this history of home care. And ours is not just a history of wage labor in the private sphere. In contrast to the usual depictions of casual, low-wage jobs that blame shady employers, it's government social policies since the 1930s that directly shaped the development of home care. including the beneficiaries of the service, the structure of the industry, even for those people who do not get public monies to pay for the service, and the terms and the conditions of the labor. As public work performed in the private home, we argue, home care illuminates the public-private configuration of the American welfare state, the workings of federalism, and the twisted logic of welfare reform, all of which were racialized as well as gendered. State organizing of home care reproduced inequality between men and women and between women by race and class, by relying upon existing divisions of labor and the social constructions surrounding them. Rather than being peripheral to the welfare state, we argue care is central to its organization, to the racialized gendered inequalities built in its very framework. Drawing upon the old socialist feminist notion of social reproduction, but racializing it, we argue that it's not just that the housewife produces use value that makes possible for the labor power of the worker and the future workers through care and socialization of current and future generations of wage laborers, or that her labor is necessary for the exchange value upon which capitalist production depends. But social reproductive labor also extends to those no longer able to labor in the market, or who could not without personal assistance, as in the case of some people with disabilities or frailties. Welfare states supposedly exist to mitigate dependencies that develop from the human condition, as well as from the vagaries of market economy. But in the case of the United States, judged to be a residual or a liberal welfare state that protects only by way of its less generous benefits as a very minimal safety net, which has plenty of holes in it, our social policy has reinforced sexual and racial ethnic divisions of labor, incorporating white women and men and women of color differentiatingly, and privileging heterosexual marriage and the family in the process. Organizing care through unpaid and low-paid labor not only strengthens pre-existing power relations and divisions of labor, but disadvantages caregivers when they seek other kinds of employment because they are said to lack real work experience. The organization of care further leaves hands-on providers without accumulated health and retirement benefits and with lower social security, making it less likely that they will be the receivers of labors of other poorly compensated care workers in the future. This outcome recycles what the larger society condemns as dependency, but that many feminist theorists have recognized as the bonds of care that mark humanity. Now, when we speak of home care, we're really concerned with the frontline support workers, personal attendants, in-home supportive service workers, and home health aides. And I won't go into an ethnography. There's some very fine ethnographies in one of the sessions later today. And I won't go into the demographics of home care, though to say that there has been a shift from the 1930s to the present with Latinas and immigrant women of various groups replacing African American women as dominant in this workforce. The status seems natural, of course, because policymakers and the public alike assume as one person from the Professional Institute in New York put it, women would always be willing to provide care and companionship for our loved ones. Well, the conflation of home care with domestic labor is historical and not merely some categorical equivalency. Not only has home health care as work been defined against and through domestic service, but home care laborers, their hospital and nursing home counterparts, and household employees often have been the same people who have moved in and out of public assistance as well. Home care became associated with domestic service because it originated in programs called homemaker or housekeeper, in which the worker substituted for the labors of an incapacitated mother. It was a substitute mother's movement initially. And it was initiated by these private, nonprofit, usually, social welfare agencies. But with the crisis of the Great Depression, these agencies turned to the federal government. There also was a parallel crisis in the public hospital system, which wanted to get the chronics, as they were called, outside of these public hospitals to free beds up. And so under the New Deal, there were a number of experimental projects under the Works Progress Administration, and these were called visiting housekeeper programs. And part of the impetus for them was as an alternative to the notorious street corner, what were called slave markets, for domestic work. And so they were, again, low-paid, hands-on domestic labor for African-American women who were targeted. But it was considered better than private household employment in the depths of the Great Depression. Later on, we have employment bureaus for domestics sending women into homes to assist the elderly and infirm people. Advocates sought to upgrade private household labor, and unions, beginning in the 1970s, looked to organize domestic workers but found home care workers instead. Labor law added to this linkage. The extension of women's work for the family, it was thought, into the market had created an area easily cordoned off as impossible to regulate. New Dealers refused to recognize the home work, the home as a workplace, partially an outcome of the Southern Dixiecrat hold on Congress that eliminated from major legislation occupations where African Americans predominated. But it wasn't just the Dixiecrats, and I think this is really important. At least we think that only Southern races created this order. If we turn to the war on poverty, for example, we see how liberalism itself, with this ideological separation of home from work, public from private, reinscribed what the New Deal order had begun, the lesser status and the exclusion, thus the non-citizenship in the welfare state, of poor women of color relegated still to a service sector that retained elements of servile household labor, as this history illuminates. And if we look at the war on poverty, two aspects. First, that manpower programs, which were supposed to improve the labor status of low-income workers, built upon existing racialized sexual divisions of labors and structures in the labor market. Nurses' aides and hospital orderlies, home health aides and attendants. That's what poor women, particularly women of color, were channeled into, which kept them poor and low-waged. And second, to meet the political demands of a reemerged senior citizens movement, Johnson successfully passed programs that required such a low-wage labor market to carry them out. The independence of the elderly then and non-elderly disabled people depended on the low wages of the caregivers. We see this in Medicare, Medicaid. We see it in the Older Americans Act. And the welfare administrators explicitly acknowledged what they were doing. And if I had time, I would read you some dastardly quotes. And thirdly, state governments restructured their home care programs so to turn workers into somebody else's employee or into independent contractors. They dealt with attempts at unionization, say, in New York City, and also responded to demands to some of the stakeholders that they control the hiring of such workers by saying, we're not the employers. And they try, and state governments and local governments try to have some other level of government pay for the service. And I think that's really important. So you get a political crisis, who's the employer? Now, if I had more time, I would go into something that happens in the late 60s and early 70s, but I want to just briefly explain what happens. When domestic servants are finally written into, in a limited way, albeit that I think Evelyn Glenn will talk more about, the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1974, home health care workers are written out of it. How could that have happened? Well, in part, you read these hearings and they're just like, huh? But two things were happening. It's incredibly convenient. Just as we have this fiscal crisis through Medicare and Medicaid and this attempt to recognize that the demographics are changing, who's going to care for long-term care, that it's very expensive that state governments don't want to pay for people having 12-hour shifts and such. They don't want to pay more than the minimum wage. They feel they can't afford. They set up an equation of consumer versus worker. Just as all of this is happening, these workers are written out of the labor law. And it's extremely convenient. And there is some understanding that people knew that a home care worker was not a elder companion or a domestic servant. But there was a conflation in this period that developed, because home care belonged in the minds of policymakers to welfare, poverty, health, and aging, not labor standards. And there were some interest groups, including the Private Care Association, previously known as the National Association of Companion Sitters and Referral Services, essentially a nurse registry, that claimed later on to be one of the principal proponents of this exclusion, arguing that coverage under the labor law would adversely impact the care recipient. Well, in the period between 1974 and the 1990s, the organizing of home care workers begins, led by SEIU mostly, although there are other unions involved. And with the Clinton administration, there's the beginning to try to change this rule that had been administratively promulgated by the Department of Labor. But every time there is this attempt, there is a struggle by these different groups, including employer associations, local governments, and even some of the disability community, claiming that, well, if you pay the workers more, we won't be able to get the care we need for our elders. And so groups are pitted against each other. But the trade union movement does realize and goes into coalition, and our larger book tells this story, with the disability rights movement and some of the senior movement to talk about better care and better work. So now we have to, of course, unpack that, but we can't do that right now. Recently, the Supreme Court, however, has decided that home care workers belong to the feudal manors of the past and are not under the labor law still. And they made their determination in a very technical sense. But it came out of this ideological belief that we only have a finite amount of money, and if we pay the workers well, we can't get the care that we need. So in conclusion, I want to say that home care continues to exist in a clouded netherworld between public and private, employment and family care. By definition, the work occurred in the privacy of client homes. A space projected is better than institutional venues for care. The home still appears as a separate sphere apart from the world of work. However, law, social policies, and professionals' use of state regulation itself fostered home and community settings, relying on the stigmatized and low-paying hands-on job to curb the cost of and meet the demand for long-term care. But there never existed an inevitable logic of policy progression. Politics mattered. And by making what was private public, state policy set the possibility for a new political unionism that has united workers, consumers, and voters to demand better wages and better care.
One of the things that's wonderful about this panel is that it brings together domestic work, care work, sex work, so we'll deal with all of the issues of the conference. Our next speaker is Laura Briggs, who's an associate professor of women's studies at the University of Arizona, where she also holds affiliate appointments in history, anthropology, and Latin American studies. She's the author of Reproducing Empire, Race, Sex, Science, and U.S. Imperialism in Puerto Rico, and is currently working on a book on transnational and transracial adoption. And her paper is from that work, Transnational Adoption and International Intimacies.
Thank you. Those of us who work on soft subjects like family or reproduction are often excluded from the conversations about the hard politics of neoliberal globalization, sometimes consciously, but more often and more tellingly without anybody thinking about it at all. And so I particularly welcomed Eileen Borris's and Rossel Pardenas's very interesting provocation in this conference to think about all the ways relations of care and intimacy are monetarized and set within a context of international labor relations. What's interesting is that the business pages of the newspapers are increasingly pointing to this sort of rapprochement between the public and the private, the two distinct worlds that feminists have long said rely on each other and liberalism requires to remain separate. And what I'm thinking of is privatization. Feminists know about the private. And in the midst of this free market fundamentalism called neoliberalism that's gripped us since the late 70s, I suspect that there's a great deal to talk about in the traffic between the privatization of government functions, military functions, prisons, healthcare, and so forth, and the expanding realm of the private space of the family, where children, the elderly, and the sick are increasingly cared for in the absence of a shared social cost of that care. So in this paper, I want to think about neoliberal privatization and its paradoxical effects on the private space of the family through three figures: a Guatemalan infant displaced from her birth family through adoption to the United States, and a 20-something Guatemalan woman, let's say the mother of that child, displaced from her natal family and her other children through migration to the U.S., where she works as an undocumented nanny for my third figure, a middle-class U.S. woman in her 40s. The infant cost its adoptive parents in the neighborhood of $30,000, including payments to lawyers, Guatemalan foster parents, and those who procured visas and passports for the child. The child's mother, in contrast, is valued at very little in terms of what her wages can command, what wages her labor can command, and what her life was worth, crossing first Mexico and then the Arizona desert, where women are three times more likely to die than men. And while we dwell on the unfairness of that, perhaps setting it in the context of the hypervaluation of fetuses in the U.S. abortion debate, we might recross the border into Guatemala and notice how this Guatemalan infant is valued. Racially minoritized, one of more than a dozen distinct indigenous Mayan groups, her existence, we could say cynically, is a result of the failure of the genocidal campaigns of the 1980s and 90s. If her birth mother placed her with relatives, it's doubtful that they could afford the fees to send her to school, and she might well find herself working for slender wages indeed by the time she's six or seven. Or if she didn't have relatives, the virtual absence of a child welfare system in Guatemala would mean she might at best be raised in a church orphanage for a few years, perhaps later to join the massive population of street children doing sex work or sniffing glue. Adoption to the U.S. is serving as a privatized welfare system for the ferociously neoliberal Guatemalan state, which is bitterly fitting given the U.S. role in defeating other visions of the state in Guatemala. Her mother, although equally racially minoritized, would have a higher value in Guatemala if we measure by her ability to earn wages, say, or that she'd be less likely to die of treatable disease or malnutrition than an infant separated from family. In puzzling out how the fact of borders reverses the relative value of these two human lives, it's clearly important to set them in relationship to the problems of domestic labor and value in middle-class, largely white U.S. American families. Zarli Hochschild noted in her 1989 book, The Second Shift, an increasing number of heterosexual mothers entered the labor force to offset a decline in real wages for their husbands, and it created a gendered labor crisis at home. Women were still doing most of the domestic labor and fighting with their husbands about it. At the same time, at that time, it seemed that in order to resolve this crisis, men would have to do more childcare and housework. Women's wages were becoming a non-negotiable part of domestic economies. It turned out, though, that there was another way to resolve this problem for middle-class families: delaying childbearing until a time when a mother's wages might be higher, and then hiring a nanny from outside the United States, as her wages would be significantly lower from what a middle-class U.S. woman could earn. Now, this is a risky reproductive strategy, though, because both partners fertility declines as they age, most conspicuously women's beyond the age of 35, at more or less exactly the moment when she might be established in a career. Rising ages at reproduction for women have led to increased rates of impaired fertility, met in part through transnational adoption. Thus, since the late 70s, we have a conspicuous growth in transnational adoption, and those who can engage in it are increasingly wealthy. This narrative is also relevant for lesbian and gay families who, while they might not have a specifically gendered labor crisis at home, are nevertheless caught up in the same problem of managing domestic and wage labor in the context of child rearing and a structural infertility. Now, as Pierre Ondagnu Sotelo has pointed out, in the last two decades, growing numbers of middle-class households in the U.S. have included domestic workers, mostly of Latin American origin or ancestry. And this has shifted Hochschild's crisis of reproductive labor economically downward to bring the who's watching the kids question to a greater number of working-class households in the U.S., or across national boundaries, as mothers leave young children in their home countries to support them by doing domestic work elsewhere. As Pereñas has argued, this is a cost of reproductive labor question. If an increasing number of middle-class households in the U.S. are relying on labor from elsewhere because they can pay women from Latin America lower wages in their homes than the women in the U.S. household are earning outside the home, it's also true that migrant women who leave their children in home countries are relying on the lower cost of reproductive labor outside the U.S. It's a form of offshore reproduction that has been at once crucial to other forms of globalization, including the superheating of the U.S. economy, and to a significant extent ignored in discussions of globalization. All of this, of course, begs the question of why some labor and some children are worth more than others, and why borders do the work they do. This paper is interested in a particular genealogy of how these bodies, families, and labor came to be differently valued. First, I explore how moral panics around race and parenting rendered some children less desirable than others. Second, I suggest related hysterics around parenting turned middle-class parents into guardians of their children. And finally, I'm interested in how transnational adoption from Latin America emerged in the 70s and 80s in conjunction with these nations' civil wars and dirty wars. Taken together, I suggest these three developments begin to account for the peculiar story of the relative values of the Guatemalan woman and child I tell above. Now, let me start by stating the obvious. There never was a golden age in the U.S. when reproductive labor was understood to be our common social concern, to be supported by the state and a wider community. However, there were moments that seemed to offer the promise of something different. In the 1960s and 70s, feminism and the welfare rights movement advocated wages for motherhood and wages for housework, daycare centers, and other support for reproductive and domestic labor, and had some successes. By the Jimmy Carter administration of 1976 to 1980, a White House conference on the family was suggesting that government had a responsibility to help families since, for the first time, a majority of mothers of young children were in the paid labor force. Or we could say, since the problem of how to manage child care and wage labor had crept downward on the class ladder. From the 1980 campaign on welfare cheats, it was obvious from the outset that it was high on the agenda of the Reagan and then Bush I administrations to shut this space down. How they did this was a textbook case for neoliberalism. They began by demonizing working-class Black, Latino, and Indigenous women and children as unworthy of help, plagued by personal irresponsibility and moral and intellectual inferiority, and then moving on to white and middle-class families, particularly mothers and children, as potentially just like the demonic working-class Latino, Black, and Indian families, and they would be like them if they got government assistance, irresponsible with damaged children. In place of this, neoliberals offered personal responsibility and security. I'm thinking here of how crack babies, fetal alcohol syndrome, and child car seats and bike helmets became major public policy issues. Now, I've written elsewhere about how the invention of the crack baby in the 1980s was part and parcel of the civic disenfranchisement and sanctioned impoverishment of Black and Latino people in the U.S. in the Bush Bush 1 and Reagan administrations, particularly by identifying them as producing bad families. In this piece, though, I want to think about fetal alcohol syndrome, FAS, because it did double work. First, it demonized Native American mothers, and then it turned on usually white middle-class mothers. Together, crack babies and FAS provided a cover story for neoliberal decimation of the social contract between the state and its most vulnerable citizens by making the case that personal private irresponsibility was illegitimately making outrageous claims on the public purse. In 1989, American Indian scholar Michael Doris published The Broken Cord, an influential account of fetal alcohol syndrome. And although fetal alcohol syndrome had been identified in the research literature as early as 1973, and had received passing mention in the media and in court cases, it was Doris's book that put it on the map as a public health emergency. The first half of Broken Cord is a tremendously compelling novelistic account of the adoption of his son, a toddler with developmental delays, and the crashing to earth of Doris's hopes that environment was everything as his son continued to exhibit growing health problems and learning disabilities. As the narrative progresses, Doris becomes very angry with Adam's birth mother, imagines her turning to alcohol repeatedly during her pregnancy. Quote, if she had come after him with a baseball bat after he was born, if she had smashed his skull and caused brain damage, wouldn't she have been constrained from doing it again and again? Was it her prerogative, moral or legal, to deprive him of the means to live a full life? And by the end of the book, Doris is insisting that as many as one in three American Indian children have been irredeemably harmed by maternal drinking during pregnancy. The Broken Cord initiated a wide public conversation in the U.S. about fetal alcohol syndrome, culminating in Congress requiring labels on alcoholic beverages warning pregnant women against drinking. Television and print media stories decried child abuse and even genocide perpetrated by indigenous women. Pregnant alcoholic women, mostly Indian, went to jail to protect their fetuses, notwithstanding the appalling pregnancy outcomes for women in jail. American Indian children with developmental disabilities were overdiagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. A 1994 genetic study on reservations in Arizona found that two-thirds of the children diagnosed with FAS did not have it, suffering instead from Down syndrome or something else. And the entire debate terrified middle-class women who didn't drink very much. FAS devolved from a problem diagnosed in the children of alcoholic women based on medical research on pregnancy outcomes in women who drank an average of 10 drinks a day to a warning to all pregnant women not to drink at all. Uncertainty about how much alcohol caused fetal defects emboldened public health officials and the media to claim that any alcohol use at all during pregnancy constituted fetal child abuse. Doris's partner, Louise Erdrich, in fact, summed this all up when she said, the one glass of wine a day permissiveness of first-time yuppie mothers is still sufficient to cause brain damage in fetuses. Now, no one has the slightest idea of whether that's true. Yuppie mothers in the 80s were never demonized in the way that black or indigenous women were. Still, for them, the 80s was a period of intensifying anxiety about their vulnerable children. In contrast to the 60s and 70s, child advice books aimed at middle-class mothers turned mean. In contrast to the reassuring Dr. Spock, who told mothers that if they listened to their children and their own common sense, all would be fine, mothers in the 80s got Richard Ferber and T. Barry Brazelton. The new advice books warned of multiple dangers of bad parenting, urged disciplined approaches to making your child sleep alone and to potty train, the need to educate oneself about developmental guideposts. The 1980s also marked the emergence of new anxieties about child death and disability. Sudden infant death syndrome began to attract media attention in the 1970s. In 1984, uncorroborated reports of poisoned Halloween candy or candy with razor blades in it inaugurated an era in which parents were to go out trick-or-treating with their children, or not let them go out trick-or-treating at all. Stranger kidnapping and sexual abuse generated countless news stories. Mothers Against Drunk Driving identified alcohol-impaired driving as a threat specifically to children. In 1987, California became the first in a series of states to require bicycle helmets for children. And public safety campaigns brought new laws requiring children to wear seatbelts while riding in cars. This decade's emphasis on parenting as something learned and easy to get wrong was not a product of an expansion of leisure time that allowed parents to choose to spend more time with their children. Far from it. And while feminist scholars have often commented on the ideological production of the difference between public and private in the 19th century, we have less reliably noticed that this line between public and private is a battlefield, that its location has moved and changed. The 1980s expansion of the private was at once an attack on feminism and the incursion of neoliberalism, replacing belief in public services with private familial labor. At a time when there might have been a widespread demand for publicly funded daycare, daycare became a place where children were routinely sexually abused. At precisely the moment when middle-class U.S. American mothers most needed them, sturdy, self-reliant children disappeared. It sounds true. I'm guessing. So in some ways, it's not surprising that at the same time there was an explosion of interest in the U.S. in transnational adoption. Middle-class domestic space had grown increasingly important. Efforts to manage home and work were resulting in steady advances in the age at which women had their first child. Moral panics about crack babies and fetal alcohol syndrome had left many who in an earlier generation might have adopted children from U.S. foster care leery about potential disabilities and the racial politics of doing so. A vision of unregulated markets was gaining real traction, and at least ideologically, the state was in decline. Manufacturing plants began to move easily and repeatedly to wherever poverty was the greatest, assuring the lowest wages. Third world workers began to be seen as interchangeable. And babies entered this world as similarly mobile, and adoption followed gradients of poverty and civil disruption. Wars in Korea and Vietnam had produced the first big waves of transnational adoption, and now adoption followed in the wake of advancing neoliberalism and civil war. Between 1973 and 1983, the number of intercountry adoptions to the U.S. doubled. Most were still from South Korea, but the numbers from Latin America were growing exponentially. In the late 70s and 80s, the most significant Latin American sending countries were Colombia, Peru, Guatemala, Chile, and Paraguay. Now, this is a striking list. Each was run by a right-wing government with close ties to the U.S. Each was engaged in a dirty war against leftist insurgents that included massive human rights violations against civilian populations and used disappearances, clandestine arrests, kidnapping, and murder as a tactic of terror. Activism by human rights groups in places like El Salvador and Guatemala, Argentina, have made it increasingly clear that child kidnapping was also a tactic of terror, followed by adoption within the country, but also to the U.S. and Europe. Court cases have used the disappearance and adoption of children as the major, sometimes the only, dirty war crime that can be prosecuted. Where amnesty laws foreclosed many possibilities of legal action against war criminals, kidnapping followed by adoption are ongoing crimes not covered by retrospective amnesties. And as a result, organizations of parents of disappeared children and the grown children themselves have emerged as some of the most important groups in Latin America's pro-democracy movements and the demand for legal accountability for war crimes. But in Guatemala, unlike the rest of Latin America, the really significant number of adoptions occurred after the wars as the markets were opened. Through the 1980s and until the 1996 peace accords, the numbers of adoptions from Guatemala to the U.S. stayed at around 400 a year, and thereafter they shot up with 3,783 Guatemalan adoptions to the U.S. in 2005. Despite repeated efforts at reforms, each a tacit admission that perhaps all was not well before, many still regard the Guatemalan adoption system, in the words of one human rights lawyer, as a nest of corruption. So to return then to the story with which I began, The historical conditions under which middle-class U.S. households might decide to hire Latin American women to do household labor or adopt Guatemalan babies, or Guatemalan women decide to migrate or relinquish their children for adoption, has changed dramatically since 1970. Privatization has meant the expansion of the private for some and its virtual evisceration for others. We've told the story of neoliberalism as a story about states and economies, but it's at least as important to tell it as a story about families.
Okay, now we're moving along to sex work. Our next speaker is Laura Maria Agustin from London Metropolitan University, who studies cultural and post-colonial issues linking commercial sex, migration, informal economies, and feminist theory. She currently lives in London, researching the situation of migrant workers in the city's sex industry. Most recently, she's the author of Sex at the Margins, Migration, Labor Markets, and the Rescue Industry. And her paper is entitled A Multiplicity of Acts, Acting, and Caring, the International Sex Industry.
Here's the book. That's the important thing. It's about to come out in the US. It's already out in UK. And I feel I came here because, for once, I thought this was a great different kind of way to frame things and not have to talk about the stuff that I've been talking about for more than 10 years, which is about migration and the sex industry and what I ended up naming the rescue industry, which, by the way, those are ladies who care. That's about caring, yes? So there's all kinds of stuff to say about caring and not asking people first what they would like. But I did that. So I wanted to talk about... try to blur some of these categories. I imagine that the people in this room understand what I'm talking about completely, but I find that it's quite common for people not to understand and to think, oh, well, those are the caring workers over here, and here are the domestics, and then there are these people called sex workers. If you know my work, I don't even talk about sex work. That's someone else's business. Because I know too many people who don't identify with that. But the idea of that they all get put in this big slippery category called services, which I think that no one knows what that is. No one knows really what services is. And what I've been trying to look at, instead of concentrating on the different categories, is to look at what the cultural contexts are for these things. Instead of labeling them first, why don't we find out what's going on according to what people say themselves? And this led me to wonder what everyone thought they were talking about when they used the term sex. As though we understand what that is. It's bad enough with care, and the French don't know that. But sex, and in most of the work that's done, in the academy, if you talk about sex, it's usually something it becomes abstract instantaneously. So it's about sexuality and sexual identities and gender. It all goes somewhere else. It's not about blowjobs. And in the sex industry, it's about rubbing bodies and about sucking on things and spanking people and penetrating. And if we don't dare to look at that, then I think that adds to a lot of the confusion anyway. So what I wanted to ask was some questions about how do we know where sex actually begins and ends? How do we know? It almost seems too much of a taboo to talk about the very selfless, caring worker who might be from Guatemala and might be very poor, who actually does caress an old man's penis as she's taking care of him because it's the kindly thing to do, or because she likes him or something. You have to look at those kind of caresses and then imagine, what about the highly paid or not highly paid call girl who, after clearly charging for something and being aware of how much time it is and being completely monetized, or whatever, I'm hearing you say monetized, I never heard that before, wraps a nice warm towel around a limp penis after the client has come. This is clearly some kind of caring act.
They're all dynamic situations. Yeah, they're all cultural. They're determined by the two individuals at the moment. Just to mention about what Viviana was saying, that although I completely agree about hostile worlds and separate spheres, and that there seems to be less resistance to the idea that someone might be able to professionally care for someone else and pay for it and then have a normal life in which they do sex in a different, they do caring in a different way. Now, there seems to be more understanding that it would be possible to care in one way professionally and to care in another way at home or outside, whereas this is usually completely denied in any kind of situation where people sell sex. It's just sex exploitation. There doesn't seem to be any ability to compartmentalize, that a person might say, well, now I'm here at the office and so I'm behaving like this. There also seems to be very little acknowledgement of the incredibly different kinds of sex that we all have all the time, so that sometimes it's passionate and caring, and sometimes it's extremely banal, but you do it. I don't know, maybe your husband is tired, you feel sorry for him, or it's an obligation, you feel that this was part of what you signed up for, or it's too much trouble to resist. There could be money in there, you could be wondering whether there'll be a nice bottle of champagne. And I would say that the separation of these kind of spheres is definitely considered more normal for men to do, that this would be Elizabeth's point as well, that the idea that men would be able to sit at their desk and keep everything clear and then go home and be clearly with someone they care about, that's imagined to be natural, whereas if a woman does it, it doesn't seem natural. So then you get this huge conflict about sex work. Now, the frame that I've been using for a long time is the sex industry and commercial sex in general. And I've just brought out, with the help of several people in this room as writers and reviewers, a special issue of the journal Sexualities on the cultural study of commercial sex. And I just want to note that that is an entire volume about commercial sex that has nothing about victims in it. There's not a single tear, there's not a single terrible, victimized, that was all cut out. That was all cut out in favor of having something else. And the frame for the sex industry, as I've said a million times, and so I'm sorry for those of you who already know, I'm not talking about something called prostitution or something called a prostitute. I'm talking about, if we just look at the places, let's look at the places. Bars, restaurants, cabarets, clubs, brothels, discotheques, saunas, massage parlors, sex shops, peep shows, hotel rooms, private flats, bookshops, striptease and lap dance venues, dungeons for sadomasochism, internet sites, beauty parlors, cinemas, public toilets. You see, this goes on forever. In other words, you can pay for sex anywhere. There's no limit on that. And one of the things I wanted to do was mention, just try to get in our heads some of the actual physical things that people pay for. So this is not what job do you do. This is what things will people pay money to get. So, for instance, the opportunity to touch someone's breast, the opportunity to show off in front of other people with decorative, beautiful women in the background, or have your cigarette lit, to see a performance by someone in an interesting costume, such as a nurse or a school teacher, the opportunity to be tied to a bed, or to be handcuffed. To penetrate something that you don't always get to penetrate, or to be penetrated where you were never penetrated before. A companion who looks very high class for some occasion, or a companion who looks very low class for a different occasion. Someone to talk to, that's a huge category. We could talk about that all night. Instruction in how to do sex, a feeling of not being alone, a change from having to go to the movies and being bored there. A cuddle is a big category. just a blowjob or just a hand relief. Those are always referred to as though that was a single thing that's always the same, and it only takes 15 minutes, so it has no, 5 minutes, so it has no importance. There also are large categories for wifely labors, and these have all kinds of titles, and someone mentioned one of them earlier: contract wives, temporary wives, concubines. So what you have here is an enormous population of the good boys who have good real jobs, called miners, farm workers, seafarers, soldiers, pilgrims, oil riggers, who all go away from home for a long period. And it's quite normal all over the world, all over the world, it doesn't matter about culture, for those people to be surrounded by people who offer them all kinds of domestic, caring, sexy labor wherever they go. There are fabulous, absolutely fabulous quotations from lots of people who do this. I stuck a couple into these notes that I threw together. One comes from Indonesia, where the woman said, a contract wife or bar girl who becomes the girlfriend plays the role of a wife, a constantly flirting friend, keeps the house with the help of a domestic servant. Keeping the illusion of romance is part of the contractual agreement, and while such arrangements last, both parties are expected to adhere to the illusion. So there's all kinds of opportunities to get into these ambiguous situations. Another huge category that people from different parts of the non-first world will recognize is there's an old profession called matchmaking. There are many kinds of commercially arranged marriages. They cannot all be lumped into one thing called an arranged marriage. Something recent from Lou was talking about trade marriages, blind marriages, arranged marriages, love marriages, and marriages of convenience all the same. In other words, the love one happens to be the one that's popular in the West right now, but there's all these other ones. It's also extremely common. This is a huge, in Europe, this is a huge new area that people are going into to marry to get papers. I did that myself once already in my life, and it's not impossible I'll do it again. It's very well known, marrying for citizenship rights and feeling that that's a rational decision, but also coming to like the person that you did it with and to be grateful and to have sex out of gratefulness and all of that. There are also all these sugar relationships. So these are the sugar daddies and sugar mummies who, this has to do with poor people, usually older, and richer people, usually older, helping out poor, sexy, cute, young people who would like to have more money than they have and use sex to get it. So I really wondered about the question of caring itself. So obviously in my huge, culturally relativistic definition, caring includes caring about someone else's experience, even if it's paid for. Emotional labor can mean faking, clearly faking, but it can also mean having temporary emotional involvements, even if they're involuntary. So you have prostitutes who have orgasms who didn't plan on having them, but things went well. It was pretty good sex. It worked. Caring can be physical, as in if you're about to fall and I reach out my hand to help you not fall. That's a kind of caring. If you give me a hug and I hug you back, I'm doing something, and I can withhold that squeezing you back. Caring can be manifested in teaching and cleaning, so showing clients how to use condoms well in a nice way. That's a kind of caring. Or having a shower with a client. You actually think he stinks, however, the nice way to do it is to get in the shower with him and make sure he gets clean and smells good. So it emerges, caring like loving and flirting, they emerge at all kinds of odd moments. And there's nothing that says that money being involved excludes caring. I have no idea why that would come about. Juliana and I will probably be talking about it 20 years from now. It's not clear to me why. How did that get there? It doesn't really make sense. And there's some kind of, I think it's really important to think about what the main story about love is, love and caring in the present popular, powerful societies, which is, it's a cultural prejudice about love and long-term relationships. And I think if you're an anthropologist, you can only see it that way. It just happens that now this is what's considered the real good way to love. And so that sex is part of this story in a way that there's a high-quality sexual experience that's morally worthy, that goes together in a home or in a long-term commitment in some kind of way that's constructive and meaningful. And that story simply excludes enormous numbers of people who like to call themselves polyamorists or swingers, who have open marriages, who call themselves radical fairies or ethical sluts is a good one. People who like to have sex with strangers. There are lots of us that like to have sex with strangers. Or who would like to have the right to have no sex at all without people getting all upset about it. No partners, no sex, just relationships in the world. If you want to talk to people or touch them, then that's part of it. And this kind of prejudice about what kind of feeling is the best one for us to have extends into ideas about sex, so that the best sex is the one that takes a really long time. Yeah, you're supposed to be in bed for hours, you're supposed to get really sweaty. It's also supposed to be, everything should be simultaneous, mutual, and symmetrical. Yeah, so we have this incredible model that very few people can come up to, can actually do this well, or once, more than once a year. That's the good sex. That's the good sex. And there's some kind of very primitive distinction made between love and lust. It's impossible. The idea that there's some kind of sex that we do that's just physical. Just physical. So what is that? You have no emotions at all. You have no feelings. This is not really happening. This is just engineering, hydraulic acts. Anyway, there's no machine to measure how meaningful or how much anybody feels at any particular moment, and lots of people like fast sex and they feel strong about it when they're doing it. And this, none of this, when it has money in it, I see no way that you can distinguish between this sex industry stuff and dating, for instance. Dating. Forget about marriage. Dating. So that obviously acting occurs, but it doesn't exclude other feelings. Lots of people don't think of what they're doing as sex work because they think it's a really strange little activity that they're engaged in for a while and they don't have any identification with it. The other thing about acting is that a lot of customers, clients, know perfectly well that they are being acted to. And they appreciate the act. They appreciate that, and they think that it's really nice that the act was done well. And that doesn't matter whether it's the girlfriend experience over some months or whether it's just a talk in a lap dance club. People who provide companion services for tourists, for instance, beach boys and tour guides, all attest that the contract can be made without anything overtly sexual being in it, and the affection kind of grow over a week or so, or it could be the other way around, that you contracted someone for the fast sex and then you happen to like them. I would caution against using any kind of class analysis here. The idea that the street worker at the bottom is more robotized and more mechanized and therefore never has any feelings. There's very nice research by Angie Hart and Don Kulik that show how the lowest of the low, if you like to think of them on the street, are enormously sexually attracted to their clients, who like to have siestas with them, who will help them with other things and cook for them. And I don't believe that's why this is international, that it's something about North-South or citizens, migrants per se. I think it's all much too multiplicitous and complicated to generalize about. And I've felt this for a long time, that sometimes I think that all of my work could be summarized in one sentence, which is, everyone does not feel the same way about sex. Yes, That's it. Trying to come to the absolute truth or the best generalization or to really know with, just look at all the people in this room, all the people in this room and the different kinds of tastes and desires and feelings. My anthropological decision about this is that there is no way to arrive at the truth here, and that acceptance would be a very good thing. Thank you.
Okay, our final speaker is going to bookend where we started with Eileen. Evelyn Nakano-Glenn is professor of gender and women's studies and ethnic studies at the University of California at Berkeley. She's the founding director of the Center for Race and Gender, and among her books is Unequal Freedom, How Race and Gender Shaped American Citizenship and Labor. Her current book project is called Forced to Care, and her title today is slightly different than what you have, Paid Caring Labor in the Home, Still Unfree After All These Years.
Good afternoon. I hope this doesn't come as a thud after that very lively talk. I won't be able to talk about all these kind of interesting acts. Okay, so as my introduction mentioned, I am at work on a book, and it's something that I've been working on for some time, and what I've been trying to do is talk about the kind of underlying coercion underneath caring labor, even though I'm not trying to deny the complexity of emotions and empathy, but sort of after looking at caring work, or what I used to call reproductive labor, for many years, I really felt that there was this kind of undercurrent. And I was also trying to come up with a way of thinking about both paid and unpaid within the same model. And just by coincidence, recently in June, something that Eileen alluded to, which was the Supreme Court case that was decided in a case involving a 73-year-old Jamaican immigrant, Evelyn Koch, who had been employed by something called Long Island Care at Home to care for elderly clients in their own homes. And basically, the court ruled unanimously that she was not entitled to back payment of minimum wage and overtime. She's now retired, and she had often worked up to 70 hours a week over her 70-year career. And she's now disabled and in a wheelchair and has to have dialysis 3 days a week. So listening to the oral arguments during the testimony phase in April, she said, "I hope they try to help me because I need help bad." Now, if you look at what the justices were saying, none of them were actually focused on her situation at all. It was basically a technical argument about the Department of Labor's regulations. And Stephen Breyer was the only one who expressed any concern about what the concrete implications of a ruling were. And what he said was, if you win this case, and when he says you, he means the lawyers for Mrs. Koch, and he's not really talking to Mrs. Koch. He says, if you win this case, it seems to me suddenly there will be millions of people who will be unable to do it, and hence millions of sick people will move to institutions. So, you know, this particular decision, plus Breyer's quote, I think raises a series of questions. That how is it that the federal government and the courts, who express concern about the elderly and the need to keep them out of institutions, also say that the very people who take care of the elderly in order to help them stay out of institutions are not entitled to the same legal protections that most other workers enjoy? And how is it that an employer, in this case a profit-making a company, does not have to adhere to the nation's hour and wage standards? And the particular question I think raised by Justice Breyer's musings is, why is it that the entitlement of care receivers and their families, I should say, is very important, can nullify the rights of Mrs. Koch and home care workers? Okay, there's something going on there in terms of that sense of entitlement. So I tackle this question by examining the history of legal and governmental policy approaches to paid home care. And I look at the way in which this history has been intertwined with two histories, one of marriage and family law, and the other, which is racialized servitude, that is indentured slavery and so forth. So with regard to marriage and family relations, up through the mid-20th century, courts have maintained the doctrine of marital service, that is, the idea that women, by entering into a marriage, contract the obligation to provide wifely services, which include care. Initially, this was stated under common law as a kind of mutual obligation where the wife provides certain services, the husband provides support. It was understood as an economic exchange. What happens over the course of the 19th century, as you get married women's property laws that sort of throw that formula of the husband earning owning the wife's labor into question, is that they start talking about the fact that wives owe that by reason of sort of affection, love, and you know, those sorts of reasons. And in a sense, they start denying the economic exchange basis of marriage. So this is kind of where this whole thing that everything that's done within the family should be done for love and not for economic reasons. Scholars have pointed out that this belief in the special character of the home as being a realm of altruism has had profound implications for the treatment of paid home care. So, you know, just as Viviana was talking about the discomfort with paying family members for care, there's also this kind of discomfort with recognizing paid care workers as actually really workers, and to sort of align them also with those kind of altruistic relations. And so there's a way in which legislatures and courts have dealt with paid workers as though they're quasi-family members rather than as fully autonomous workers. And then because they have walled off the private household as off-limits in terms of regulation, home care workers then are particularly vulnerable to conditions of, you know, what I would call servitude. The other historical trajectory has to do with racialized servitude, which has existed in the U.S. Well into the 20th century. That is, despite the banning of indenture and chattel slavery in the years after the Civil War, blacks, Latinos, and Asian immigrants who worked in such industries as agriculture, mining, and infrastructure building were subject to coercive labor regimes through such mechanisms as debt bondage, sharecropping. There was also the convict labor system, and things like payment in scrip, which could only be redeemed at the company store. Those sorts of things, which basically tied workers to their workplace, and where domestic service or home care comes into this is that generally women from those groups were recruited into being servants for the managers and the owners. So the men were engaged in these kind of primary industries, and the wives and daughters were then inducted into service. So overall, the state, representing the interests of employers and property owners, have treated relations between employers and domestic employees as a combination of traditional status relations and property relations. And by status relations, I'm talking about duties that accrue to someone simply by virtue of occupying a particular position within a status hierarchy. So in this case, a wife in relation to the husband. And so when I look at that marriage and family law, there's a way in which that notion of status obligation continues to see as operative. So, you know, this is part of where the idea that wives and family members should provide care without thought of any kind of compensation, because it's already part of their obligation by through the marriage relation. So things like private contracts between husbands and wives, where the husband agrees to leave a portion of the property in exchange for the wife's nursing services, are declared null and void, because he's not really getting anything, any consideration for that, because the wife is already obligated to provide that. And these cases actually run all the way to 1993, surprisingly. And then property relations, where there's a assumption that the employer is entitled to the services of the employee at whatever time the employer wants them, and the employee is assumed to be obligated to be available at any time to do whatever is asked. And this relationship stands in marked contrast to the ideal of contractual relations, in which rights and duties are delimited by contractual provisions and public regulations. So consequently, the exclusion of home care workers, I would argue, is a kind of dual exclusion, one based on this notion of the private household and the kind of familial relations and status obligations, and on the other hand, the continuation of this, what might be called a quasi-property relationship between employer and employee. So I don't know, how am I doing in terms of time? Oh, okay. Okay, now that's page 4, and I have 35 pages. No, So I wanted to sort of rehearse that argument just in case I got cut off. So in the paper, I review, 1790 to 1865, and 1865 to 1930, and then New Deal. sorry to be so hasty here. I think the important point is the New Deal, you know, which was sort of considered to be the bringing of modern labor relations, so-called modern labor relations, completely bypasses domestic workers, who are basically left out of the NLRB, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and so forth. And the decisions on this are related to the idea of the home being this sort of sacred space. For example, a 1939 Minnesota court ruling upheld the conviction of a domestic worker for constituting a nuisance by picketing in front of the home of his employer on the grounds that the worker was not entitled to protection by a Minnesota statute that entitled all workers the right to organize. And the court said, the home is, quote, a sacred place for people to go and be quiet and at rest and not be bothered by the turmoil of industry, unquote. Okay, so it's clear that this sort of notion of the private household is very important in terms of this exclusion. But what I wanted to talk about is something that, again, Eileen alluded to, which was this 1974 Fair Labor Standards Act, which was attempting revision that Democrats were attempting to include workers who had not been included before, including domestic workers. And what you have is, on the one hand, the Democratic proponents arguing on the basis, interestingly enough, of the value of women's household work, sort of saying that has value, and therefore when it's paid, it should also have value. And the Republicans basically continually raising the figure of the 14-year-old boy that you hire, next door boy that you hire to mow your lawn, and that if he earned minimum wage, he would spend his time drinking lemonade and, you know, in order to extend the workday. And also kind of the idea that the live-in worker is spending a lot of time kind of enjoying herself. So Peter Dominick of New Mexico says, what do we do about the cleaning lady that comes in? She enjoys herself. She gets together with the family and has a Coke or a milk of glass. She has business with the family. She cleans up and does a good job. In most cases, she's being paid far more than minimum wage if she happens to be a cleaning woman, because they're so hard to get these days. Some of the Republicans are also saying that they kind of evoke this notion of the domestic as a faithful family retainer, and the idea that if minimum wages were imposed, then retired individuals and social companions who might perform infrequent tasks for a household may be asked to leave for economic reasons. It certainly is a sorry state of affairs when government forces such lifelong loyal employees and friends from households in their senior years. So the idea is that most household workers are unproductive, and you know, if you enforce minimum wage, they would have to be fired. What ends up happening is that the Democrats agree to, limit the provision of coverage to full-time domestics, or you know, those who qualify for Social Security. And again, there's an exemption for live-in domestics based on the idea that, majority committee report stated, ordinarily such an employee engages in normal private pursuits such as eating, sleeping, and entertaining, and has other periods of complete freedom. In such cases, it would be difficult to determine the exact hours worked. That this is a very different account that's given, from domestic workers who basically say they're on call, you know, around at all the time. What happens is that the final version then contains what something that's called a companionship exemption, where people who are babysitters or companions to either elderly or the young are exempted. But then what happens is that the Department of Labor, that wage and hour division, comes up with regulations about what this means, and they actually broaden it to include home care workers who are actually employed by agencies, as well as those who are employed by private individuals, even though if you look at the congressional debate, it's clear that they're only talking about people who are directly employed by the household. So basically then we come to back to the Evelyn Koch case, which was supported by SEIU, and I guess both Eileen and I had signed on to a amicus, and it's kind of interesting in terms of who are the parties that are writing amicus. And so you have AARP and the Association for Elder Americans filing in favor of Koch. And then on the other side, you have, of course, the home care industry, but also the city of New York and various state and county agencies who are saying that this will be a total economic disaster if, in fact, home care workers were to receive minimum wage and maximum hours. In 2003, the U.S. Federal Appeals Court for the Second District ruled that the DOL regulations were interpretations and did not have the force of law. And the Department of Labor then issued another opinion saying, well, that may only be for the Second District, but for the rest of the country, basically our regulations hold. So then we get to the final decision. And as I mentioned, the only person who expressed anything other than technical objections was Stephen Breyer. I think this sort of notion about employers' entitlement is something that has run through historically. A legal historian, Peggy Smith, had noted, for example, that employers have always been unwilling to even consider voluntary restrictions when there were kind of efforts to try and get these voluntary contracts in which some reform women were trying to get housewives to sign these agreements that would, you know, have certain maximum hours and so forth. And what she says is that the typical household employer reasoned that as long as she had a domestic in her employee, she was entitled to expect around the clock service. Of course, as a free laborer, the domestic could always terminate the relationship. While the relationship was in effect, though, the prevailing sentiment held that she should be at virtually all times accessible to the employer. One other kind of, I think, really interesting piece of evidence is found in U.S. immigration laws. Domestic workers fall under the lowest category as far as skill is concerned, and therefore they have almost no chance of immigrating as independent immigrants. But it's very easy for them to come in as dependents. So there are sort of special visa categories, B1 category for U.S. citizens who are returning for abroad. There's A5 for diplomats and consular employees, and then there's a G category for employees of international organizations. And what's interesting there is that they can bring dependents that include their wives, their children, and their servants. So if you kind of think about the logic of that, it's kind of the idea that these household employees, in a sense, belong to the employer, and they're entitled to bring. Because it's hard to think of, you know, people being able to bring their accountant or, I don't know, you know, their masseuse or their personal trainer. Well, maybe a personal trainer, I don't know. But it's sort of the idea that they're kind of an extension of the household, and so it's kind of like a property relations. Okay, so conclusions. So despite the increased commodification of in-home caring labor and reliance on paid caregivers, paid labor has not been included in the so-called modernization of labor relations and has been treated as part of the private family realm rather than as part of the market. As capitalist relations have penetrated more and more into social relations, there seems to be an even greater desire to preserve the distinction between home and market and to maintain the home as a private refuge from market values. So in one sense, by virtue of its location in the home, caring work, whether paid or unpaid, is treated as though it is governed by altruism and status obligations. And so scholars have seen this particular characteristic as resulting in paid domestic workers suffering various forms of exclusion from benefits and rights that are accorded to other paid workers. Yet the exclusion of home care workers from social citizenship rights stems not just from their enclosure within the private household and their quasi-family standing. Their exclusion also grows out of their status as quasi-property. Like property, servants and other paid carers can be discarded when no longer useful. Unlike a family member, the home care worker is not owed the kind of reciprocity that is due a family member, and the employer does not incur the kinds of obligations that are incurred toward family members who provide services. In this sense, paid caring labor that's done in the household is doubly coercive. It is part of the household system that is hierarchically organized according to common law status principles, and it is part of a property relationship that denies the independent personhood of the worker and vests property rights in the employer. So I will just end there. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.